comes in, but I anticipate I will. It's been a long position of mine.
Baldwin voted for the Affordable Care Act as a member of the U.S. House and discussed it extensively in her first race for U.S. Senate in 2012. She's up for re-election next year. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Minor League Baseball, the Kingfish lost to the Battle Creek Bombers 12-3 last night. The Fish are back home tonight to play the Fond du Lac Dock Spiders 7-05 at Simmons Field. Major League Ball, the Brewers hammered the Cubs 11-2. White Sox were off. Tonight, the Brewers play the Yankees in New York. Cubs host the Pirates down at Wrigley. The White Sox play in Colorado. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Friday the 7th. Sunny and seasonal, 50% chance of rain this afternoon, heading for a high today of 80. New numbers are in. Wind from the south-southwest at 7. Humidity still kind of high at 83%. 71 degrees under a cloudy sky. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 12 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance your career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's at 2401 60th Street, also online at andreasgifts.com. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
I have a feeling that many of you have in your closets at home what I have in my closet as well. Beautiful, wonderful, comfortable, inspiring t-shirts and sweatshirts with the label Life is Good. And on top of that, maybe you have baseball caps or dog leashes or even a really neat little book called Life is Good, Simple Words from Jake and Rocket. This is an extraordinarily successful company. Created and run by two brothers, Bert and John Jacobs. And the whole idea behind the marvelous products which they create is to spread the power of optimism. And they do that in all kinds of different ways. And one of the best things about the company Life is Good is that they do so many things to make the world a better place, not only donating 10% of their profits right off the top to some very, very worthy charities, but also in the way that they conduct their business and interact with their customers, they are doing so much good. They have a book called Life is Good, The Book, How to Live with Purpose and Enjoy the Ride, in which they lay out not only the lives of optimism which they have lived and where that optimistic spirit came from, but also lay out for us, the readers, 10 different superpowers which aid them in living the lives that they do. And it's an absolutely terrific book. I already plan to get several of them and share them as gifts. It's not often I say that so blatantly over the air, but I have no hesitancy in saying it about this book called Life is Good. And I'm thrilled to be able to speak with Bert and John Jacobs, the founders of Life is Good and the co-authors of this absolutely terrific book. Bert and John Jacobs, we welcome you to the morning show.
We really appreciate you having us on.
Happy to be talking to you. Really happy to be talking to you. I wish we had more time to be able to talk about something that's really delicious in your book, which is your account of your childhood, which you call Our Perfectly Imperfect Childhood, in which you say your folks bitten off a lot by trying to raise a family of six kids on a slim salary. A familiar story, I'm sure, to a lot of people. One of the things you say, though, is your mom was the first powerful optimist in your lives. Tell our listeners some of the ways in which that powerful optimism was lived out and made such a deep impression on you.
Yeah, there were really, you know, every family faces challenges, and there were really two major factors in our childhood that were challenging. One was economics and maybe too many kids and not enough money. And the other was that our parents had a near-death car accident when we were in grade school. And our mom had a seatbelt on and so survived with only broken bones. Dad almost died and ended up losing the use of his right arm. And he became heavily depressed, and yelling and screaming in the household became a daily soundtrack. That was extremely challenging, but our mom was the one that really kept the family together. And she did so by focusing on what was right rather than what was wrong. So she had a tradition at the dinner table where she looked around and said to all of us, "Tell me something good that happened today." And as simple as that request was, it changed the energy in the house. So, you know, years later as adults, when we kind of landed on our feet and started selling T-shirts, it became a huge factor in, you know, sort of funneling us towards a more optimistic message, which ended up being life is good. So our mom really was the first powerful optimist in our lives, taught us a lot, and was the inspiration for life is good.
Hmm. And we'll talk a little more about her story before we're done. Explain to our listeners how and why you first got the idea of trying to make your living selling T-shirts. It sounds like there were a couple of different things at play in your mind, and we're talking about your first efforts before you ultimately founded this incredibly successful company. But in the early going, with that really modest beginning, what was at the heart of choosing that as what you hoped would be a path to success?
Well, I think we felt T-shirts were a great canvas for messages. We've always liked to write and draw since we were kids. Our mom was an artist, and I encouraged that sort of thing. And we also looked at it as an accessible way to combine art and business. And we were looking, as we got to college and talked more and more about what we wanted to do, we didn't really know, but we thought it would be incredible to be able to create art for a living somehow. And that's what led us to T-shirts. And then we just gave it a shot. We went to a screen printer, and we took to the streets of Boston, and then bought this used van and started going up and down the East Coast selling in college dorms.
One of the things I appreciated about your book is you really lay out the tough road that was. I'd heard some relatively vague accounts about how you started really small, and it was not easy in the early going, but wow, you guys really hit some walls, and a lot of people who were not at all receptive to what you were doing, and it seems like this was one of those paths of great discouragement, and somehow your optimistic spirit survived that.
Yeah, I think in one way to look at it is it's all we had. You know, we didn't have money, we didn't have experience, and we really didn't have professional skills. But we had a message that, or even before life is good, we did have the optimism. We had that, you know, taught to us since we were kids. So, you know, one thing that prevents people from starting businesses and taking risks or chasing their dreams is that they're afraid to fail. And one thing that an optimist can do, and it was very powerful to us early on, was we didn't look at days as failures where we didn't sell any T-shirts. So we could be in the street selling all day and at night in the dormitories and not sell a single T-shirt. And rather than saying we failed today, we would look at it and say we learned today. What did we learn? We didn't sell those shirts for a reason. Either we had the wrong graphic or we had the wrong color or we were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we can improve based on that. We looked at it as a benefit that we learned. And then the next day, you know, of course, you can't have too many of those days in a row. So the next day you have to make adjustments and get out in the market and do something different. I think, you know, the way you frame things and the way you view the world is very powerful, and that's what optimism is about. A pessimist will focus on the obstacles, but an optimist will focus on the opportunities. And that's kind of what kept us going in the early days.
I love the phrase at one point in the book when you describe these early days as a lot of trial and even more error. But at some point...
we made a lot of mistakes.
At some point, though, you ended up creating this now iconic figure known as Jake. Just briefly describe kind of the moment when that there was that creative spark, and in particular the person who kind of saw that drawing and said something about it that really kind of drew it all together.
Yeah, so this was a big lesson to us that ends up kind of continuing throughout our whole careers with Life is Good. One conversation while we were traveling in the van was about the fact that the media is almost systematic pessimism in that it inundates our culture with negative information, always reinforcing what's going wrong in the world. And we wanted to create some symbol that celebrated what's right with the world. So JJ drew Jake with crayon and magic markers, the original character. And when we got back to Boston, we had a tradition of throwing a keg party. We put all of our artwork up on the walls, and a girl who was at the party drew an arrow to Jake and wrote, it didn't say life is good, it didn't say, you know, she just wrote, this guy's got life figured out. And we loved that, but we realized it was too many words. So in the morning, we distilled that into the three words, life is good, and that was it. So the lesson, you know, 2 days later, we sold them in the street. We sold 48 T-shirts in 45 minutes, and it was immediately commercially viable. But the lesson was that we didn't have to come up with it. You know, people will help you and people will come up with ideas for you if you enable them. That's, you know, part of why, you know, one of the superpowers is openness. You have to be open to people. So immediately that girl at that party, she kind of gave it to us without knowing it. We were searching for something, but in a sense, she came up with it, you know. And then we were smart enough to distill it and then to trademark it. And, you know, that continues, as I said. So, like, the retailers then evolved our brand for us. And today it still continues. It's our customer base that's building the business with us.
And if I could add, you know, the customers that taught us the most were the ones that wrote these incredibly personal stories about going through adversity and... you know, whether it's chemotherapy, losing loved ones, and they would say that optimism helped them, you know, focus on what they should be grateful for, just for having a sandwich, just for having a friend to talk to, just for hanging out with their dog, and these simple pleasures that we often take for granted. People that go through tremendous adversity, they have this heightened sense of gratitude. And so to Bert's point, you know, we learned from our friends at the keg party, then the retailers, then, you know, this deepest message of all was like that life is not perfect, life is not easy, but life is good. And if, especially if you're able to focus on what's right in your life and the world and grow that good.
And that's where these superpowers, you know, we call them superpowers. They're values that are accessible to everybody, and they all come from our customers. So, you know, you get enough letters from people that are going through really difficult things, and they express that they're so appreciative of what they have in their life, that you realize that gratitude is a superpower. You get enough letters from people that say, you know, what they're drawn to about life is good is the simplicity of it. It's childlike. It's so simple. Their life is so complex. There's too much information, et cetera, and they want to just focus on the things that they love. So simplicity to us becomes a superpower. You know, the same is true of creativity, of authenticity, openness, courage, all of these things that are kind of timeless. But the more, all we had to do was kind of listen to our customer base. And over time, these things showed up so many times over and over that we said, okay, that's it. Those are the things that are enabled by this, this thing we call optimism. And maybe the most important thing is that optimism really isn't a soft philosophy. It's a pragmatic strategy for approaching life. And, you know, the more we practice it, the more we wake up in the morning and say, okay, you know, how do I focus on what's right in my life rather than what's wrong? That's the things that are going to grow. We're able to put our resources towards making our life happier and more fulfilling.
We're speaking with Bert and John Jacobs, the founders of the company Life is Good, and we're talking specifically about a really terrific book that has just been published by National Geographic, actually, called Life is Good, the book. And yes, indeed, the heart and soul of this book is the array of 10 superpowers, as you call them, that can be, in a sense, the ingredients to a truly optimistic life. When you talk about openness in the first chapter, you talk about two words that are so important, and those words are yes and, saying a quick no stops the flow, yes and lets you build and grow. And that's really a way in which you've lived that out in the way that you've grown your company.
Yeah, you know, that phrase originated from improv comedy, and that's the secret to why actors can get on stage and support each other and create a scene out of nothing but a suggestion. And it's amazing to watch live, but you can actually apply it to your everyday personal life, work. I mean, we've all been in meetings where people are afraid to offer new ideas because, you know, the first instinct sometimes is for others to talk about why it won't work. If you flip that and just kind of roll, give it a few minutes to breathe and say, yes, I like that, and what if we do this as well? The momentum is, like, unstoppable. You can always edit it out at the end of the meeting and decide to go in another direction, but to give ideas a little chance to breathe and grow is huge. And think about that in your personal life. Your friend wants to take an adult ed class, or your spouse or something. Instead of telling them why that doesn't make sense or you're too busy, yes and, maybe, you know, I'd love to take that with you, or I've been thinking about taking this class. Any conversation can be aided by that simple phrase.
The second chapter is devoted to courage, and in this chapter you tell an incredible story about your sister, Berta, and a devastating injury which she suffers while in a skiing accident, and her remarkable comeback. It must have been especially touching for you to share this kind of a story which had such a powerful connection to the two of you so directly.
It was hard, yeah. You have feelings for a long time. I mean, our sister, it was a paralyzing ski accident. So immediately following the accident, she was completely paralyzed, unable to move. But over time, in our opinion, her courage, her optimism, her openness, and a great team of doctors, enabled her recovery. And while her body will never be the same, the important thing to us is that the accident caused her tremendous pain and difficulty in her life, but it never took her beautiful smile away, because she knows that's who she is, you know. And so the courage to embrace and to rehab and to work her way back as best she could is a superpower. But, you know, the authenticity superpower is there too, because she kept that smile through everything and has been a huge inspiration to us. She asked herself, you know, when she was in the hospital, you know, what are her choices, you know? She could frown and, or she could smile. And she said, if the smile is the courageous choice, that's an easy one for me, because if I get upset, how's that going to affect my family and everybody else? So, you know, she thought about everybody else involved. And so she's been just a huge inspiration to us.
And that mental switch went off in the hospital, she said, where she said, I'm going to focus on the progress. You know, and every little bit, she wiggled a toe one day. She moved her hands. And that was like where she focused all her energy, on what was the next step of progress. And that's something we can all learn from.
I love the quote you have of her at one point saying, every step of the way, I felt lucky. I mean, it's amazing when someone in the midst of something like that.
To this day, she has tremendous challenges, you know, and setbacks. But she says, another one I love that she said is, I don't let it ruin, you know, it's going to ruin my next 10 minutes, but I'm not going to let it ruin my next hour. And that's how she looks at these things that would frustrate us all very much, because her hands don't work very well, and she doesn't move around too well, but she does not dwell on that stuff. This is a real inspiration to us all.
I'm sure. You talk so beautifully about simplicity, the importance of, in your words, chiseling away at the excess and cutting to the core. You quote Thoreau and Leonardo da Vinci saying that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, which I like so much. I appreciate what you write in one chapter about humor and in another chapter about fun. And about fun, you say that fun is more than just frivolous. It really can make an enormous difference. And it sounds like you take fun very seriously at Life is Good. I mean, even in terms of how you conduct your business, the way your workplace is put together, you really are anxious to foster that.
Yeah, absolutely. Saying we've found that in general, in business and adults in general, we tend to get away from that superpower of fun. And, you know, it's magnetic. It really draws people in. It's attractive. And we've found that for our staff, they're actually more productive, and we're more productive together when we're able to have some fun. So we talk about blurring the line between work and play, and you know, this idea of hump day on Wednesday and grinding through your work week, and even the phrase work-life balance doesn't make sense to us, because you know, by very definition, that would mean that they counter or oppose each other. And that doesn't make sense. I think the better approach, regardless of what you do for a living, is, you know, find some fun in the week. Find some way to bring fun and bring the things that you love to your office, to your work. Because the chances are, if you're able to do that, you're going to be more passionate about your work. You're going to be more enthusiastic about it. And you're going to attract better, stronger, more talented people, because who doesn't want to have some fun?
And
as especially as we become adults, that has to be a conscious decision to inject fun. I'm going to bring fun and a certain energy to my coworkers, to when I get home from work. And we find, as Bert said, it's unifying, and it kind of lifts the whole team and actually makes you more productive in addition to making the workplace a lot more enjoyable.
You also talk about compassion, creativity, authenticity when you talk about dogs, and you end with love. Nothing is stronger than love. A beautiful account of in the wake of the Boston Marathon. Your company is based in Boston, and how you responded to that tragedy. And the book ends with an absolutely lovely account of your mother's courageous battle with cancer, and what an inspiration she was to all of you right to the end. Life is Good, you say, is the Swiss Army knife of gratitude. I want to finish there. Explain that phrase. Life is Good is the Swiss Army knife of gratitude.
Well, it's actually the phrase that we refer to there. It's get to, and it was one we picked up from our community, and it's the idea that you don't choose to say, I have to go, you know, to a meeting. I have to go grocery shopping. I have to do the laundry. You get to go to a meeting because you have a job. You get to do the bills because you have a roof over your head. You get to go grocery shopping because you live in a world of, you know, a land of abundance, and you've got eyes to read the labels. I mean, it's a simple one-word switch, but we learned it from our community, and it's extremely powerful. We apply it to work and home, and we feel like it's the Swiss Army knife of gratitude. And we get to be on the road right now for 60 days. And one thing we want to enable people to do is help us raise money for kids while we're on the road promoting this book. If people hashtag grow the good and tell us something good that happened today, then we're going to donate another dollar to kids who need it. We've raised over $11 million for kids who need it. And we're very ambitious about raising more. So your listeners, just hashtag life is good. Hashtag grow the good, And for every hashtag, we'll donate another dollar.
Wonderful.
Think of that. I mean, that benefits the person writing it because they're focused on thinking about the highlight, just like our mom taught us at the dinner table. And it's benefiting whoever's reading it. You know, they're reading that instead of hearing about the latest disaster. And we feel like that's really powerful around the world.
Of course. This new book is just terrific, start to finish. Again, it's called Life is Good, The Book, How to Live with Purpose and Enjoy the Ride, published by National Geographic and written by the co-creators of Life is Good, Bert and John Jacobs. Bert and John Jacobs, thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you for creating this terrific book. I am so glad we got to talk about it today. Best wishes to you.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it very much.
We spend this portion of WGTD's morning show talking about a very interesting memoir. In fact, the subtitle of this memoir says, A Memoir of Going to Extremes. And boy, that is a really apt way to describe the story of Francis Slakey and the story told in his memoir, To the Last Breath. Professor Francis Slakey decided, for sort of an interesting mix of reasons, to undertake a very rare, maybe unprecedented gauntlet, to climb the highest mountain on every continent on Earth and to surf every ocean on Earth. And along the way, in ways that he could not possibly have anticipated, Francis Slakey ended up sort of discovering a lot about himself and in a sense, opening himself up to new experiences, especially on sort of an emotional level that he had never anticipated before. Growing from a state which he at one point in the book describes as cold and broken. It's really an amazing story, and a story full of surprises and also some really death-defying drama as well. And I'm very excited that I can speak with Francis Slakey, or should I say Professor Francis Slakey, Upjohn Lecturer on Physics and Public Policy at Georgetown University. And he writes a great deal on the relationship between science and society at large, co-founder of the program on Science in the Public Interest. And maybe you have heard him on NPR or seen his work in National Geographic, Washington Post, The New York Times, and other places. This book, again, is titled To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes, published by Simon & Schuster. Francis Slakey, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Pleasure to be on.
This is quite an interesting story, and I would also say that it's a very, in a sense, sort of asymmetrical story, or maybe I don't want to sound uncomplimentary, but it's kind of an untidy story compared to some books. I mean, in the
sense... it makes me wonder how many people's lives are actually tidy to begin with. I think when you set out to write a memoir, either you try to clean it up and gloss it up and make it pretty, or you just tell things as they happen. And in my case, I just told it all.
Absolutely.
I told it all as it happened. Yeah.
It's one of the things that makes this book so really very, very interesting and unexpectedly so, in the sense that we might glance at the cover and glance at the title and figure that this is going to be another book about climbing a lot of mountains. And there are a lot of books out there like that. But in many respects, what ends up being far more dramatic for you than climbing Mount Everest is the experience of sort of self-discovery and self-transformation that occurs to you.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it began, some of that transformation began at Everest. The whole journey took 12 years, and there were moments in the journey where just completely unexpected things happen. You know, I tell you, Greg, when you set out into the world, you discover there are things that happen out there that are way beyond your control. And when I began the journey, I think I just thought I could control all my circumstances and discovered pretty quickly into it that that things were just way beyond what I could control myself. And those things eventually just influenced me to the point where I became a different person.
Before we actually talk about your story, I wonder if you could just say a word about what you understood at the time versus what became clearer as you sat down and wrote this book. I think I talked to a lot of authors in which the act of sitting down and putting a story down on paper provides all kinds of clarification. I wonder if that was really the case with you. It sounds in many ways like much of the clarification really did happen through the course of this journey. And then the
it
book
did
is
happen. It was it's an interesting combination, Greg. So it did happen through the course of the journey. And just to make it clear to your listeners just how much change there was in my life, you know, 15 years ago, I had what I called my pillars. I mean, they were the foundations of my life. And it was I would never get married. I would never have kids. I would never buy a house because any one of those things would create attachments. And I just didn't want any attachments. And here I am more than a decade later, married. I have twin girls in a home that I own. So all of those pillars just tumbled away, and they tumbled away one after another over the course of the journey when I realized that I had just been thinking way too narrowly about myself and about the world.
In describing yourself before this transformation took place, you at one point evoke the words cold and broken.
I do. You know, it's something that people attributed to me, and I don't think I fully grasped it at the time, but I had started out my journey by going to Africa and climbing Kilimanjaro. It was a routine climb. Nothing unexpected happened on the climb itself. It was, as I found so many times during the journey, it was the circumstances that surrounded the event, the climb or the surfing, that influenced me. And in the case of Kilimanjaro, it was when I confronted some Maasais in the savanna that surrounds Kilimanjaro, and I met with one of the elders of the tribe, and we had, you know, an exchange, and I sort of stepped into things. I ended up writing a story about it. When that story was published, readers reacted sharply to it and suggested that I was cold and broken, and that I think I hadn't really confronted that until I read the readers' responses at that point.
And of course, this whole journey around the world and all these adventures end up being kind of a gauntlet of self-examination and coming to better understand this truth, uncomfortable truth about yourself. Let's turn back earlier though into the story for a moment. Because one of the most interesting moments in the story, in the book, is when you take us back to when you were 11 years old and your mother died from cancer.
Yeah.
And describe this moment to our listeners and describe what you believe to be its sort of lasting consequences.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those moments, Greg, you had asked a few minutes ago, were there things that came to me in the act of writing the book. And I think this is one thing I really came to grips with when I wrote the book. And this was when my mother died when I was young. But shortly before she died, we were passing each other in the hallway. She had declined, her health had declined to the point where she could no longer walk. And my father was carrying her down the hallway. And there she was in his arms. And it was a narrow hallway, and my father had to turn. And so we passed each other. My mother and I barely touched each other. She didn't say any words, but I felt something at the time. I mean, I heard her voice. I still hear it today. And she said, "Be strong." And I think at the time, I misunderstood what she was trying to convey with that, and thought that I interpret it more as defiance and, you know, get out there in the world and conquer it and take it on. And it was only much later in my life, in fact, at the end of my journey, when I realized that those words had a much different intention.
I think that really makes a lot of sense that I think a lot of people can act in that way and believe it on some level to be exactly the right thing to do, to put up sort of a stoic front to try to kind of thicken one's skin, if that's possible, and sort of weather the blow rather than really feeling it deeply. And do you feel like that sort of marked you for a long time afterwards? I mean, is that what sort of set you on this path for such a long time of of, in a sense, living coldly and disconnected from others.
Yes, I think so. I think that certainly contributed to it. Shortly after that, I was in Utah, and a friend and I were climbing, and he decided he wanted to try to climb down a mountain. I was uneasy about it. I told him I would meet him at the bottom. I would take a bus ride down the mountain, and he could climb down on his own. And he fell in his attempt to down climb and died from that. And you know, so it was, I think those two things back to back, Greg, really just iced me up and made me the detached person I was for so many years.
I really think you put it well in describing going back to actually to your mother's deterioration and eventually her death from cancer. You said that I reacted by thickening my defenses. I decided that I would never again let something cut into me so deeply. And, of course, little could you have imagined that the journey out of that state of being would involve mountain climbing and surfing and so on. I mean, I think the unlikelihood of that and the fact that all of this surprised you is probably a big reason why it happened. I mean, why it ended up being, in a sense, the most effective sort of cure for that.
Yeah, well said. I mean, I think when you it helped me step out, and it made me realize, particularly when I had a confrontation in the jungles of Indonesia, I would say that was one of the real turning points in my life. And let me just say a few words about it for your listeners. But there's a mountain in Irian Jaya that's surrounded by jungle, and rather than trying to hack through all the jungle, my climbing partner and I decided that we would cut through a mine that butts up right next to the mountain. And in order to do that, we decided we would bribe the Indonesian military that guards the mine. I have to make that confession to your readers that that I did commit that felony offense of bribing a military officer, but in any case, that officer took the money, drove us up the mine. We did our climb. We drove back down. And as we were coming back down the mine, soldiers stepped out in front of the Jeep. They started yelling at us, and our driver started yelling back. I didn't understand what was being said. I yelled at the driver, "What's going on?" And then suddenly this voice cut through everything, and I did understand it because it was in English. And the soldier said, "Get out of the Jeep." And we got out of the Jeep. We were surrounded by the soldiers. I figured we only had a few moments to come up with some solution, and we just opened up our wallets. We just gave them more money, and they backed away, and we drove on. But then a few days later, I discovered when I picked up an international newspaper that someone else was in a Jeep driving down the very same road, was surrounded by soldiers at that very same spot. But in their case, the soldiers pulled the triggers. And two people were gunned down dead, seven more critically injured. And just a few months later, I would be sitting across the table from one of the women, Patsy Spear, who survived that ambush. She had been rushed to a hospital. She had 100 pieces of shrapnel in her internal organs. Her internal organs actually had to be taken out, put into a tray in front of her, and tweezed to take out the shrapnel. And she survived that. And when I sat across the table from her, and talked through that ambush and realized I was talking to somebody who had taken the bullet instead of me. I had dodged a bullet and met the person who took that bullet instead of me. And I tell you, Greg, that just changed my life. Mm. It really brought me out of my shell. Mm.
In the experience that you actually had, I mean, of being in such dire danger. In that jungle in Indonesia, one of the things you describe that is just sort of searing in its intensity is you say this situation was totally outside my control. There was no rope that I could decide to pull or not pull. Instead, there were only triggers, and it was up to the soldiers, not me, to decide whether to pull them or not. This was not the kind of dramatic moment that I seek. This was utter helplessness. I mean, I think all of us can well understand how frightening a situation like this would be. But in a sense, for you, it was even more than frightening. it was also for you probably the most vulnerable and powerless you had ever felt in your whole life.
Yeah, that's true. And I, it's at so many stages in my life, decisions that I made, I felt like I had control of the circumstances, and it was up to me to determine what path I would follow. And when I confronted that situation, it was truly just, and it was outside of my control, and there was this helpless feeling that I had. And then, you know, compounding that just days later to find out that someone else was in the same situation and had the disastrous outcome of you know, bullets being shot at him. And I to the combination of me experiencing the helplessness and then discovering, actually meeting the person who had to survive that ambush, it's a very powerful experience.
We're speaking with Francis Slakey about his book, To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes. That's really probably the most dramatic, but by no means not the only moment in which your life was in danger and you were taxed beyond your sort of immediate abilities and resources. I mean, really brushing up against danger, that happened again and again. You say early in the book, the journey, this ultimate journey that you take all around the world, would completely unravel me and then bind me back together into someone who could feel and care. I wonder if you could say a word about the process of being unraveled. And if we are talking about, for instance, that those experiences of complete vulnerability that you just described happening in the jungles of Indonesia at gunpoint, or if we are talking about other factors beyond that, and maybe some fairly subtle that that also contributed to this process of unraveling.
Certainly it was Indonesia and the helplessness I felt at that moment. There were other moments along the way. Let me describe one to your listeners. It was on Everest, and I think what I summited solo, so I was alone. It was there was a blizzard. It was just whiteout conditions, and then in my descent, I discovered a couple other climbers who had gotten into just horrible circumstances. And what I witnessed was just the heroism and the selflessness of my climbing partner, Jim Williams, and his, you know, lucid decisions and his willingness to put his own life at risk to save another. And that seeing the heroism of someone just being in that circumstance, confronted with the same decisions that that he is confronted with, but seeing him make the decision that would put his own life in jeopardy to save another. Well, I tell you, it's, you know, it's like holding a mirror up to yourself, and you discover who you are, and you discover just how pure an act can be, and that's what I saw, and that certainly contributed to my own change.
You so powerfully and vividly describe the experience of being in Antarctica, which at one point you describe as one massive sensory deprivation tank. I mean, because so much that is around you is like nothing we ever see or hear or
right.
Feel.
There's nothing for your senses to sort of seize onto, and you go through your typical day, and there's so many things that you're, you know, from the moment you wake up, your alarm clock, bang, you know, you hear something. You walk down the hall, and maybe your coffee's already brewing, and you smell that. And then you open the morning paper, and the visuals, you know, get you. You turn on your radio, and you hear Greg on the radio, and you know you're constantly confronted with sounds and sights, colors, and but in Antarctica, there's nothing. There's nothing for your senses to grab hold of. It's lifeless, so there's no sound of an animal, of a lawnmower, you know. It's odorless, you know, and you're encased in a down suit because it's so cold, you know, 40, 50 below zero, that you can't have any exposed skin. So you have nothing to touch. So there was nothing for the senses to grab a hold of. And the only thing you see is just the white of the ice and the white of the sky. And, you know, at the time that we were climbing, the sun just sort of sat a little bit low in the horizon, never set. And so it's constantly illuminated. And there's, so there's no change in the landscape, really. So, it felt like it just a big sensory deprivation tank.
Hmm. Coupled with your own experiences in Antarctica, you do such a beautiful job of describing the plight of Robert Falcon Scott and his ill-fated party who attempted to be the first to reach the South Pole, falling short. Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian, gets there first, and Captain Robert Falcon Scott and all of his men perish in their journey back. And you describe not only crucial errors, heartbreaking errors which he made, but also very movingly describe the sense of connectedness which Captain Scott seemed to feel in the last hours and minutes of his life.
That's, to me, the most compelling part of the story, Greg. So plenty of scholars have looked at Scott's expedition and determined whether he was a sound leader, just experiencing circumstances beyond his control, or whether he was an inept leader. And that's not a debate I wanted to get into, because what I found in the end, what I found so compelling is literally his final moments as he realizes he's not going to make it back. He's going to freeze to death in Antarctica, and he'll never return to England again. He will never see his family again. And it was at that moment he picked up a pen and wrote. And so you get the final words of someone who has confronted his own isolation in the most desperate of circumstances. And what does he do? He expresses his love for his family. And when I thought about that and realized, look, I don't want to die alone and detached. And so when I was confronting my own isolation in Antarctica, I thought back to that final moment Scott had and realized I don't want to suffer that end. And that also contributed to my reconnection with the world.
If we have time for one more story, I find it interesting that on the heels of that discussion about Antarctica, you turn your attention to your own father, an English professor, and many of the ways in which he raised you and your brothers, and how, in particular, he was a child of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And that guided many of the values he had and priorities as a father. I mean, I really love this part of the book, particularly the story of the glass mustard jar. I mean, in living life in that respect. Can you just say a word about the juxtaposition of these two stories in your book?
So my father, and he had such a challenging time. You know, there were three of us. I was the youngest. I had two older brothers. My mother dies, and he's got to somehow keep all this together. And, yeah, I think he went back to what formed him, which was that Great Depression. And I remember moments when we were growing up where he would hold that mustard jar up to the light. He would take his spatula and make sure he got just that last bit of mustard, like it was buffed clean by the time that he was done with it. And that stolid approach that he had, I think, is the steadiness that he had, is what got all of us through our childhood. And I did reflect on that when I was in Antarctica and realized, you know, that there were moments when we just challenged him to the breaking point. But he was steadfast, and he remained solid. And despite the challenges that I had in my own life and the burdens that I put on him, you know, he stood beside me, stood strong.
Hmm. Well, it's an amazing story. It truly is, that takes us all around the globe and into very, very surprising moments. And of course, no one is more surprised than you at where this journey ultimately takes you ultimately into marriage, ultimately into Buddhism, ultimately into a life and a view of the world that you never would have thought could be yours. And our listeners can see it all in your book, To the Last Breath, a memoir of going to extremes, published by Simon & Schuster, including some very interesting photographs, I might add. The author, Francis Slakey. Francis Slakey, thank you so much for telling this powerful